Hello, and welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Rosemary Onkwe, bringing you readings from the following publications: The Griot, The Root, Ebony, Blavity, The Beacon, Kansas City, The Voice, News One, and Anscape. Today we'll begin our readings from an article from The Griot titled, After a Contentious and Emotional Election, What Now? The Joy Lady, Tracy Michael Lewis Gidgets. TRACEYMICHAELLEWISGIGGETTS weighs in. Written by K. Wicker, November 9th, 2024. If you're struggling emotionally and don't know where to find hope and joy after the results of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, you're not alone. In addition to roughly half of the country, even the self-proclaimed joy lady, Tracy Michael Lewis Gidgets, is having a hard time in the election's aftermath. Sis is struggling, she admitted to The Griot. The thought leader, writer, and storyteller explained that in the first few days following the election, she's been struggling to know how to guide others towards joy in such a way that it doesn't feel like I'm diminishing their rightful, righteous rage, the rightful grief and sorrow that people are feeling. She continued, and so I've been struggling a little bit because it's like I'm the joy lady, right? And so I'm supposed to be bringing the joy, and I'm trying to find it for myself. I'm trying to do the work that I've done over these last few years to locate joy in my body so that I can get clarity on what my next move is. Even though it may be difficult to grasp joy at this moment, Lewis Gidgets, author of Black Joy, Stories of Resistance, Resilience, and Restoration, and its recent follow-up, Black Joy Playbook, 30 Days of Intentionally Reclaiming Your Delight, thinks joy is exactly what those struggling need right now. I will say that even in the midst of my struggle, I still believe that joy and reclaiming joy, accessing joy, is a huge factor in how we move forward, she said. Lewis Gidgets said that ultimately, joy can be our greatest asset. However, one has to be able to take the time and effort to find joy in order to wield it. This article was titled, After a Contentious and Emotional Election, What Now? The Joy Lady, Tracy Michael Lewis Gidgets, weighs in. Written by K. Wicker, The Griot, November 9th, 2024. The next article is from Blavity and is titled, How Celebrating Días de los Muertos in San Antonio Rekindled My Connection with My Late Grandmother. How Celebrating el Día de los Muertos in San Antonio Rekindled My Connection with My Late Grandmother. Written by Shaniqua Yates, November 1st, 2024. We are all keepers of stories. Each of us carries the legacies of those who walked before us, weaving their narratives with our own, often guiding that torch beyond what they might have envisioned. Día de los Muertos, a vibrant celebration rooted in Mexican tradition, is more than just a remembrance of the dead. It's a reminder that love transcends realms, and that those who leave this world never truly leave our hearts. An ingeniously rooted primarily Mexican holiday, Día de los Muertos celebrates loved ones who have since passed. For over 3,000 years, the annual event has occurred on the first 2 days of November. It includes the tradition of curating an altar, better known as an ofrenda, Spanish for offering, to invite those who have since returned from the body for a celebration. While the holiday has become more popular and modernized thanks to the Disney film Coco, the original practice includes placing a photo of the individual who has passed away on the altar, along with their favorite treats or anything that can serve as a reminder of them. One of the primary purposes of the celebration is to ensure that loved ones know that they have not been forgotten, despite no longer being physically present in the earthly realm. Día de los Muertos, San Antonio style. For over a decade, San Antonio has celebrated the holiday through its Muertos Fest, a weekend filled with Día de los Muertos activities, including the Day of the Dead River Parade, which took place on October 25th. Throughout the years, the annual event has become the largest Day of the Dead celebration in America. On October 26th and 27th, attendees immerse themselves in the culture through live music, face painting, food, and more. The real eye-opener for the weekend event was 83 ofrendas, hand-selected by the holiday committee to be on full display for those attending. In its 12th installment, the Muertos Festival included ofrendas that honored past loved ones, including but not limited to pets, iconic celebrities, gun violence victims, veterans, and a host of other altars curated to pay homage to the dead. As someone not Mexican or of Mexican descent, celebrating this holiday was truly eye-opening for several reasons. Still, the most obvious is how much it aligns with my spiritual practices of reconnecting with my loved ones who are no longer present in the flesh. How did this event reconnect me with my ancestors? The ofrenda during the event that resonated with me the most was Nuestras Abuelas, which translates to our grandmothers. It particularly touched me because I lost my maternal grandmother on November 2, 2018, which just so happens to be the final day of the Día de los Muertos holiday and the day set aside to honor departed adults who are loved ones. In the culture, November 2nd is known as Día de los Difuntos, while November 1st is referred to as Día de los Angelitos, or Day of the Little Angels, to honor loved ones who died as children. As if November 2nd wasn't already highly significant, it is also the day before my birthday, November 3rd, which has brought a mix of emotions since losing my grandmother, whom I affectionately called Gaga 6 years ago this year. Of all the ofrendas on display during San Antonio's Muertos Fest, the community altar was also striking. It engrossed those attending like myself to participate in the practice of leaving offerings for their deceased loved ones. I decided to leave a photo of my Gaga at the altar, and in doing so, it left chills up my spine, because since her passing, I often feel closer to her than ever before, and this was one of those instances. As a child of the early 1990s, when there wasn't fancy technology to prevent babies from being swapped or, worst case scenario, kidnapped from the hospital, from the moment that my mother, her youngest daughter, gave birth to me, my Gaga followed and watched her first grandchild, me, like a hawk, ensuring that I was protected and looked after. Ironically, she passed just hours before my 26th birthday. As the anniversary of her death approaches, along with my 32 solar return, this experience at the Muertos Fest was a lovely reminder that she still fiercely watches over and protects me from the other side. This article was titled, How Celebrating Día de los Muertos in San Antonio Rekindled My Connection with My Late Grandmother, by Shaniqua Yates. Blavity, November 1st, 2024. The next article is from The Beacon, Kansas City, titled, Kansas City LGBTQ community vows to fight like hell amid mental health and rights worries after Trump win. Written by Suzanne King, November 8, 2024. Election night at Blackout, BLAQOUT, in Kansas City was always going to double as a launch party for the organization's fight for policy and attitude changes towards the Black LGBTQ plus community. As vote results came in, a particularly sense of urgency followed. "We have to continue to organize beyond Election Day," said D. Rashaan Gilmore, R-A-S-H-A-A-N, the founder and CEO of the Kansas City Health and Advocacy Organization. "It would be too easy for us to sulk, to retreat to our shells, and then not be ready for the fight." Donald Trump was elected amid a flood of ads that portrayed transgender people as dangerous to women's sports and to girls and women more broadly. Now that he is heading back to the White House, transgender rights are in question. Trans people fear losing access to hormone treatments and living under an administration that campaigned on making them parias. Colleen Fagan, F-A-G-A-N, a Kansas City area psychologist who treats transgender adults, said that she worries about the ramification election propaganda has had on her clients. "For years, they have been bombarded with political rhetoric on both sides of the state line. Regular debates about legislation to take away their rights. The barrage of political ads this election season only caused more damage to their mental health," Fagan said. "I worry about that," she said. "I worry about the loss of hope. I worry about suicides." Since Trump resoundingly won the presidential election, calls to mental health helplines for people who identified as LGBTQ have shot up across the country. The Trevor Project, a national organization that provides mental health services to LGBTQ youth, said election night traffic to its hotline surged to 125% of the normal volume. The group's website continues to warn that its text and chat services are experiencing long hold times due to the election. The organization released a study in September and found that 72% increase in suicide attempts among transgender and non-binary youth between 2018 and 2022, a period when 19 states, including Missouri and Kansas, implemented 48 different anti-transgender laws. Erin Reed, a journalist who tracks anti-trans legislation, counted 550 bills introduced in 2023 to restrict transgender rights and 586 bills introduced so far in 2024. On her website, Reed said the risk of federal anti-trans legislation is growing. Many states, including Missouri, have banned hormone blockers and other health care known as gender-affirming care for minors. Other laws, including in both Missouri and Kansas, prohibit transgender girls and women from playing on girls and women's sports teams. And laws enacted across the country also place restrictions on adults, like those legislating the gender listed on driver's license and the bathrooms transgender people should use. Fagan said her clients worry a Trump administration will bring even more restrictions. Some have already begun rationing hormones they are prescribed, fearing a ban even for adults. They also fear laws restricting necessary surgery. "There are no good words right now," Fagan said. "Everyone in the community is banding together and providing support. That is huge. It's all you can do right now." Robert Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, spokesperson for PROMO, a Missouri LGBTQ rights organization, said many trans leaders need some time before they discuss the presidential election. The question is, where do we go from here? Fisher wrote in an email. Gilmore said he hopes the advocacy campaign, Blackout, unveiled on election night, will provide a good start. There is despair, Gilmore said, but in all the conversations that I've been having so far, and frankly, even with myself, that despair is not outmatched by the determination of community members to fight like hell. This article was titled, Kansas City LGBTQ Community Vows to Fight Like Hell Amid Mental Health and Rights Worries After Trump Win, by Suzanne King, The Beacon, Kansas City, November 8, 2024. Next, another article from The Beacon, titled, An Independence School is Retooling an Auditorium to Take the Load from Overflowing Classrooms, written by Maria Benevento, November 8, 2024. Fairmount Elementary School in Independence tore the shelves out of a storage closet, installed a smart television and a whiteboard, and started using the space for teaching. With enrollment booming, every room counts. There is literally not a single space that's not being utilized, Principal Nicholas Younts, Younts, said. The school can't squeeze an entire classroom into a former closet, but it is using the space and other office-sized rooms for things that happen in small groups like speech therapy and support learning English. Meanwhile, every classroom is occupied, and some are so full they can't accept more students. That's why 20 fourth graders have been sent to Mill Creek and Ott Elementary Schools as of November 1st. Some ride the bus to Fairmount, then switch to a second bus to complete their journey. This isn't a long-term solution, so the district has a plan to add classroom space and adjust school assignments, hoping to ensure Fairmount students and others can stay at their neighborhood schools. In late October, Independent School District Superintendent Dale Herl, H-E-R-L, said 77 students district-wide had transferred out of their neighborhood schools for lack of space. In close to 20 instances, an entire grade was full at a school. The trend is especially acute in the northwestern area of the district. An overcapacity school can create a domino effect by causing a nearby school to overflow into a third school and so on. The district hopes to relieve that pressure by repurposing Fairmount's auditorium into 6 new classrooms. Other schools could see boundary changes next fall to better distribute students among schools. When schools run out of space, kids get pushed out of familiar environments, spend too much time in transit, and miss class time due to bus schedules. But Hurl sees high enrollment as a plus. When you have schools that are decreasing, you're looking to having to close schools, he said. That's something that certainly would not be popular. So I'd much rather be in a situation that we're trying to figure out where to place kids. Why this is happening? Hurl can't prove why enrollment is growing in certain schools, but he thinks it could stem from low housing prices and good options of the district. Independence switched to a 4-day school week this year. It's not clear whether that's drawn families in, but Hurl said it doesn't look like a deterrent. Enrollment in grades 1 through 5 combined went up by more than 100 students. Some of the talk was that we would lose kids because of the 4-day week, he said. Actually, it's just been the opposite. Families hear about the good points of the neighborhood by word of mouth, said Terry Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R, a family liaison for Fairmount and longtime resident of the area. Those benefits include affordable homes for sale and organizations like Community Services League and Fairmount Community Center that support the neighborhood. We have a lot of families that are new to Missouri and a lot of families that are new to the country, she said. The growth could also be part of a regional trend. During an October school board meeting, Kansas City Public Schools reported that its fastest growing schools were in the northeastern parts of the district, which border Fairmount and other schools in the northwest part of the Independence District. Temporary solutions at Fairmount Elementary. Fairmount knew to plan for high enrollment based on trends last year, Younce said, though the school grew even more this school year. He filled every teaching position. But there simply isn't space to add another class to Fairmount, which Hurl said was built more than 100 years ago, and there are limits to how many students fit in a class. Those limits range from up to 20 for kindergarten and up to 27 for fifth grade. Fourth grade was the first the school had to cap, but kindergarten and fifth grade are nearing the same situation, Younce said in late October. Unfortunately, we've got some kiddos that have been with us since kindergarten, that this year they did have to go to another building just because we don't have the room, Younce said. If a space opens, the school checks who among the students was the first to register and offers them a spot back at Fairmount. But with some of the grades at overflow schools filling up as well, there is a chance any new students at those schools or Fairmount will need to be sent to yet another school. Transferring means a longer and more complex journey for those who use the bus system. I'm less concerned about the expense of transportation and more concerned about the loss of educational time, Hurl said. They're arriving at school a little bit later, and then they have to leave school a little bit earlier. Younce said it emphasizes the sad situation when students arrive at Fairmount on their first bus but can't stay. I see those kids every day, he said. We have to tell them, I hope you have a good day, and put them on another bus. Long-term plan. Repurposing Fairmount Auditorium into classrooms looks like the cheapest way to remedy the space crunch and the pressure it can put on other schools, Hurl said during the October school board meeting. Other options included building an addition or an entirely new school. He expects the auditorium project and light renovations to the gym to cost around $4 million, which the district can't afford without passing a bond. A bond could be in the future, in April 2026, for more extensive renovations of Fairmount and other building projects. Work on the initial Fairmount project could start over winter break if the board approves a bid, with the goal of finishing by next school year. Hurl said the district will keep some historical features from the auditorium, such as seats and decorative elements. We're going to reuse everything we can throughout the school whenever we do a full renovation, he said. The project will mean that Fairmount no longer has its auditorium, which it currently uses for music classes and assemblies. Younce said, one of the six new classrooms would be set aside for music, and assemblies could take place in the gym. Younce said there may be some sadness about losing the auditorium or changing the school into future renovations, but it's overshadowed by the drive to get Fairmount kids back in the building. We will hopefully be able to say to them, you're a Fairmount Bulldog, and you're going to be coming to Fairmount. And that's never going to be a question, he said. That would bring me the greatest joy. This article was titled, An Independent School is Retooling an Auditorium to Take the Load from Overflowing Classrooms, written by Maria Benevento, The Beacon, Kansas City, November 8, 2024. Next, an article from The Voice titled, The Black Repertory Theater of KC presents Hip Hop Cinderella, written by Thomas White, November 8, 2024. The Black Repertory Theater of Kansas City, fresh off winning the prestigious Paul Robeson Award, is kicking off its new season with an imaginative take on the classic fairy tale, hip-hop Cinderella launches audiences in an intergalactic adventure where the traditional story gets a fresh spin. Set on planet Zola, Z-O-L-L-A, teenage Cinderella and her rapping robot companion, Runka, R-U-N-K-A, face off against a social media-obsessed stepfamily while competing in an epic hip-hop ball to restore the galaxy's groove. This family-friendly musical features a talented cast of six, bringing this space-age story to life through dynamic hip-hop numbers. Gem Theater, 1615 East 18th Street, KCMO, November 21st to December 8th, Thursday to Saturday, 7:30 p.m., Sunday, matinees, 3 p.m. Length, 65 minutes with intermission. Tickets, $30 or $15 for student at brtkc.org. No performances during Thanksgiving week and December 6th. This article was titled, The Black Repertory Theater of KC Presents Hip Hop Cinderella, by Thomas White, November 8, 2024. Next, an article from Blavity, titled Tony Todd, actor known for Candyman and more, dies at 69, by Tomas Casajon. Candyman actor Tony Todd died on November 6, 2024, at age 69. Todd died in his Los Angeles home, but the cause of death hasn't been revealed, Deadline reported. The award-winning actor, who was born in Washington, D.C. on December 4, 1954, earned more than 240 film and TV credits during his career. His acting career started when he attended the Eugene O'Neill National Actors Theater Institute and Trinity Rep Conservatory. Todd later earned one of his first roles when he played as Sergeant Warren in Platoon, a Vietnam War classic. He then starred on numerous hit classics throughout the 80s and 90s. Some of his early appearances included 21 Jump Street, Matlock, Jake and the Fat Man, Law and Order, The X-Files, NYPD Blue, Beverly Hills 90210, Xena, Warrior Princess, Murder, She Wrote, and Star Trek, The Next Generation. More recently, Todd starred on The Young and the Restless in 2023. Todd's big screen appearances in the 1980s included Lean on Me, Colors, and the Charlie Parker biopic Bird in 1990. He played as Ben in the Night of the Living Dead remake. Todd also starred in Candyman in 1992 and appeared in the film sequel in 2021. The DC native is particularly remembered for his role in horror films. That includes his performance in the Final Destination franchise, where he played as a funeral home owner, William Bloodworth. Speaking with Deadline in 2022, Todd said he has a particular goal for every role he plays. You gotta have the audience sympathy for the character in some way or another, he told Deadline. There's gotta be something attractive about the character that makes people want to root for them, but at the same time feel repulsed by the idea. And for me personally, for every film that I do, I create a backstory for all my tortured people and my heroes alike. In 2024, Todd starred in Scream, another horror movie which tells the story of a family vacation gone wrong, per Fuzz on the Lens. Virginia Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, Todd's co-star in Candyman, expressed her condolences on Instagram after the actor's death, per WQLN. My beloved, may you rest in power sweet to the sweet in heaven, Madsen wrote. The great actor Tony Todd has left us and now is an angel, as he was in life. This article was titled, Tony Todd, actor known for Candyman and more, dies at 69, by Tomas Casselhon, November 6, 2024. Next, an article from The Root, titled, Disgusted Baltimore Mayor's Viral Comments on How the Country Doesn't Deserve Black Women Got Everyone Talking, written by Candace McDuffie, Friday, November 8, 2024. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott has gone viral for his ode to black women following Vice President Kamala Harris's loss in the presidential election. In his remarks, lamented over how this country has once again failed this particularly vulnerable demographic. It is really on my heart this morning to say that as a man, but more importantly as a black man, that this country does not deserve black women or black people, but specifically black women, Scott said. He continued, This morning I woke up and I just gave my wife a hug, because I know how heavy this is weighing on black women, and they have carried this country and saved this country too many times, and continue to be the most disrespected human beings on this planet, and quite frankly, it disgusts me. One ex-user at Kim Writes For You praised Scott for his moving remarks. Thank you for caring for our communities, and especially black women, she wrote. Men like you are a godsend, and your wife, soon coming baby girl, and Baltimore are all blessed to have you. Scott also expressed concern over the kind of world he will be bringing his child into before praising the campaign that Harris ran over the last several months. And I want the vice president to know that her and her team did everything right in the right way, he stated. But the unfortunate reality is that this country is still steeped in racism, sexism, and misogyny. His words prompted at Born Ambition 80 to label Scott the moral compass. On Election Day, Scott tweeted his excitement about Harris making history as the first black and South Asian woman president. Despite her defeat, the politician expressed his reverence for the VP. I am personally proud of her, and I know that so many others are the same. We appreciate her tenacity, her focus, her decency, and how she handled herself throughout this campaign, he said. One black woman on X, at VWoods24, emphatically agreed with a heart emoji. Despite a largely positive response from black folks, there was still a couple who questioned the necessity of his speech. One man, at Tony Lane NV, simply asked, What's wrong with Brandon? Scott's defense of Harris and his remarks were also strong. The fact is that they did everything that a campaign can do and more, but we as a country really have a lot of soul searching to do. And that's really what I want to say about that today. Perhaps the most succinct response came from at Valhunt Beauty, who called the speech heavy and thanked Scott for what he said. The mayor, using his platform to uplift a black woman, won't soon be forgotten. This article was titled, Disgusted Baltimore Mayor's Viral Comments on How the Country Doesn't Deserve Black Women Got Everyone Talking, by Candace McDuffie, MCDUFFIE, The Root, November 8, 2024. Next, an article titled, Sometimes the Fight Takes a While. Kamala Harris's Concession Speech Hints at Another Presidential Run, written by editor at News One, November 6, 2024. Vice President Kamala Harris on Wednesday officially acknowledged Donald Trump's presidential election victory while delivering a concession speech that emphasized the need for a peaceful transition of political power and messages of inspiration to the younger generation of Americans. But Harris's speech also left the door open for a future run at the White House by using language that encouraged people to look beyond the dark time. She said some may feel like the U.S. is about to enter under another Trump's presidency. Harris's speech was delivered at Howard University, her alma mater, in Washington, D.C., which was also where the vice president's election night headquarters was located on Tuesday night. Listen to the full text of Vice President Kamala Harris' concession speech on Wednesday afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all. So let me say my heart is full today, full of gratitude for the trust that you have placed in me, full of love for our country, and full of resolve. The outcome of this election is not what we wanted, not what we fought for, not what we voted for. But hear me when I say, the light of America's promise will always burn bright as long as we never give up and as long as we keep fighting. To my beloved Doug and our family, I love you so very much. To President Biden and Dr. Jill Biden, thank you for your faith and support. To Governor Waltz and the Waltz family, I know your service to our nation will continue. And to my extraordinary team, to the volunteers who gave so much of themselves, to the poll workers and the local election officials, I thank you. I thank you all. Look, I am so proud of the race we ran, and the way we ran it, and the way we ran it over the 107 days of this campaign. We have been intentional about building community and building coalitions, bringing people together from every walk of life and background, united by love of country with enthusiasm and joy in our fight for America's future. And we did it with the knowledge that we all have so much more in common than what separates us. Now, I know folks are feeling and experiencing a range of emotions right now. I get it. But we must accept the results of this election. Earlier today, I spoke with President-elect Trump and congratulated him on his victory. I also told him that we will help him and his team with their transition and that we will engage in a peaceful transfer of power. A fundamental principle of American democracy is that when we lose an election, we accept the results. That principle, as much as any other, distinguishes democracy from monarchy or tyranny, and anyone who seeks the public trust must honor it. At the same time, in our nation, we owe loyalty not to a president or party, but to the Constitution of the United States, and loyalty to our conscience and to our God. My allegiance to all three is why I'm here to say, while I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. The fight for freedom, for opportunity, for fairness, and the dignity of all people. A fight for the ideals at the heart of our nation, the ideals that reflect America at our best. That is a fight I will never give up. I will never give up the fight for a future where Americans can pursue their dreams, ambitions, and aspirations, where the women of America have the freedom to make decisions about their own bodies and not have their government telling them what to do. We will never give up the fight to protect our schools and our streets from gun violence. And America, we will never give up the fight for our democracy, for the rule of law, for equal justice, and for the sacred idea that every one of us, no matter who we are or where we start out, has certain fundamental rights and freedoms that must be respected and upheld. And we will continue to wage this fight in the voting booth, in the courts, and in the public square. And we will also wage it in quieter ways, in how we live our lives, by treating one another with kindness and respect, by looking in the face of a stranger and seeing a neighbor, by always using our strength to lift people up, to fight for the dignity that all people deserve. The fight for our freedom will take hard work. But like I always say, we like hard work. Yeah, hard work is good work. Hard work can be joyful work, and the fight for our country is always worth it. It is always worth it. To the young people who are watching, it is, I love you. To the people who are watching, it is okay to feel sad and disappointed, but please know it's going to be okay. On the campaign, I would often say, when we fight, we win. But here's the thing. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is don't ever give up. Don't ever stop trying to make the world a better place. You have power. You have power, and don't you ever listen when anyone tells you something is impossible because it's never been done before. You have the capacity to do extraordinary good in the world, and so is everyone who is watching. Do not despair. This is not the time to throw up our hands. This is the time to roll up our sleeves. This is the time to organize, to mobilize, and to stay engaged for the sake of freedom and justice and the future that we all know we can build together. Look, many of you know I started out as a prosecutor, and throughout my career, I saw people at some of the worst times in their lives. People who had suffered great harm and great pain, and yet found within themselves the strength and courage and the resolve to take the stand, to fight for justice, to fight for themselves, to fight for others. So let their courage be our inspiration. Let their determination be our charge. And I'll close with this. There is an adage a historian once called a law of history, true of every society across the ages. The adage is, only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. I know many people feel like we're entering a dark time, but for the benefit of us all, I hope that is not the case. But here's the thing, America, if it is, let us fill the sky with a light of brilliance, the light of optimism, of faith, of truth and service. And may that work guide us, even in the face of setbacks, towards the extraordinary promise of the United States of America. I thank you all. May God bless you. May God bless the United States of America. Thank you. Next, an article from Anscape titled, Slam Magazine Bounces Back Boldly with Iconic Cover T-Shirts, written by Pete Croatto, Croatto, November 8, 2024. In the upscale neighborhood of professional basketball, where the influential and zeitgeist, Z-I-G-E-I-S-T, where the influential and zeitgeist touched stretch their legs as the action gallops past, the Slam cover T-shirt has been an increasing sight, visible on everyone from Teyana Taylor to Rich Paul. And yeah, players have donned the duds. The shirts are driven by the realities of business, but nobody could maneuver a puckish magazine run by a devoted, sarcastic few into a cultural shorthand, a secret handshake for Hoops fans. Allen Iverson on the cover of Sports Illustrated was not the same as AI on the cover of Slam in a retro Sixers jersey and sporting a towering blowout. Even in their diminished state, long-standing print magazines lean towards stately, a quality never attributed to the basketball Bible. It's also the key reason why Slam continues to hold such appeal. I've always perceived Slam as your friends, said basketball photographer John Lopez, who has shot covers for the magazine. Somebody on the block who you grew up with, who speaks your language and understands your vernacular of the game, as opposed to this larger-than-life character you'll never get to be with, and you'll be lucky if you ever get a phone call from them. Long before eighth graders had highlight tapes and women hoops started getting respect, the publication didn't stick to the NBA and men's college hoops, the staple of most straight-ahead sports magazines. It paid attention to playgrounds in high school. Shamequa Holdsclaw, H-O-L-D-S-C-A-L-A-W, then a superstar at the University of Tennessee, made the cover in October 1998. Slam Dawn Staley said, really understands the game and the culture of our game, not just black culture. That started before you even cracked the spine. Dennis Page, the founder and publisher of Slam, told journalist Alex Wong in Cover Story, The NBA and Modern Basketball, as told through its most iconic covers, that he wanted to do for athletes what the cover of Rolling Stones did for musicians. When Slam finally landed access to players for photos, it happily ceded control, said Russ Bengtson, B-E-N-G-T-S-O-N, the magazine's editor-in-chief from 1999 to 2004. I think a lot of what made Slam great, and what makes Slam great, is trusting the players themselves, he said. They're the arbiters of cool, not us. We're a delivery system for it. When I was editor, I'm not going to think that I know what's cool better than Allen Iverson does. That meant players didn't have to resort to rigid poses and Are We Done Yet smiles of official NBA and team photo shoots. They could wear headbands or chains or even switch jerseys with their teammates. Lopez said nothing about the cover feels corporate. Former editor-chief Tony Gervino, G-E-R-V-I-N-O, told Wong that the turning point was the May 1995 cover featuring Latrell Sprewell, S-P-R-E-W-E-L-L, and Tim Hardaway of the Golden State Warriors, neither sporting a smile. They were obscure players to a national audience. We wanted to plant our flag as the anti-establishment basketball magazine, Gervino said. The goal, Bankston added, was to make the players look like rap stars. It was one of those things that you wanted no matter what you accomplished as a player. You wanted a cover of Slam, said Sharif Abdur-Rahim, who got his wish with the January 2000 issue. He was also part of this iconic 1996 rookie class spread. It was more than being recognized as a great player. It instilled a certain street cred, a certain kind of swagger, a coolness about you, the 2002 All-Star said. Slam was not your father's basketball magazine. My dad reads Sports Illustrated, Abdur-Rahim said. I read Slam. So does his son. Now, Abdur-Rahim, who serves as the president of the G League, said his cover gives me some coolness about me as an older guy among the players. Staley, who has won NCAA championships, coaching the University of South Carolina women's basketball team, was the first coach to land a solo Slam cover. We have pretty big egos, said Staley, a Hall of Fame hooper, but you never think you're big enough that you will be on the cover of Slam. Swagger only sells so many magazines, though Slam, Lopez said, has adapted to the Hall of Cracked Funhouse Mirrors that is the digital age. They do a phenomenal job of pairing the print with the digital. Magazines need to continually reinvent themselves. So when Paige visited Lynn Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, director of Authentics and Archives at Mitchell and Ness, he had an idea. Don't you think people would wear Slam cover tees? The partnership made sense. Their covers are spectacular, Bloom said via email. They use the best photographers in the industry, so images are always striking and memorable. And there's synergy. In many cases, the athletes on the cover is wearing a jersey that we now made, so it's a natural fit. The shirts provide a way for people to rep both Slam and their favorite players, observed Adam Figman, CEO at Slam. But it's a revenue stream and a cross-promotional bonanza. It's great that we found a new way to grow our business, Figman said in an email. Media is a tough business, and the cover tees have helped us expand into a really crucial way. The shirts, he notes, had been bootlegged for years. When Staley visited Philadelphia, her hometown, guys from the neighborhood wore her shirt. It's that kind of cool cultural thing, she said, that connects or reconnects the people who really know you. During Bankston's time at the magazine, the cover was a very ephemeral sort of thing. Yeah, the staff would sweat over the cover lines and other details, but this stuff is going to be gone after a month or a month and a half. Though Slam sells shirts with contemporary stars, the Slam cover has been part of that nostalgia for the player, Vince Carter, Shaquille O'Neal, on and on. Many photos in Slam, Bankston added, became the definitive images of these guys. The cover, Figman said, remains some of the most coveted media real estate there is in sports and basketball world. And the cover tees are another opportunity for us to showcase just how much of a needle mover the cover remains. Does that translate to people buying an issue of the magazine? It's possible, but probable, not common, Figman admits. I think more likely someone would see someone else wearing a cover tee and either think, I need that shirt, or I hope my favorite player is on a future cover so I can get the shirt when it happens. Though it recently celebrated its 30th anniversary and was honored by the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, Slam is still a shoestring operation, Bankston said. It's still the Wizard of Oz. You pull the screen aside, of this incredible professional-looking glossy magazine. It's still just a couple of people doing it, Figman said. SLAM's ability to keep the cover relevant is partly attributed to the staff's elite understanding of both who's hot at any given moment and who's next. In a permanently temporary industry, an influential magazine is enjoying an extended relevance. For some former SLAM staffers, there is another benefit. To see that history live on a little bit in a different format now is very cool to see. This article was titled, SLAM Magazine Bounces Back Boldly with Iconic Cover T-Shirts, written by Pete Croato, Anscape, November 8, 2024. Next, an article from The Griot titled, Whoopi Goldberg Hopes to Change the Sports World with Her New All-Women's Sports Network, written by Hanaya Philogene, Hanayah Philogene, November 10th, 2024. Whoopi Goldberg is taking on a new project. During an appearance on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, the EGOT winner announced her leap into the sports world with the launch of her first global women's sports channel, All Women's Sports Network, AWSN. I'm launching the first global women's sports channel called AWSN. It'll be the home for live women's sports from around the world, she told Fallon. Everything from soccer, basketball, tennis, cricket, curling, you name it. If a woman is playing it, we're showing it. According to its website, AWSN will be available in 65 countries and will be dedicated exclusively to women's sports, featuring some of the world's largest sports leagues, such as the Union of European Football Association, UEFA, the International Basketball Federation, FIBA, the Women's Tennis Association, WTA, and the Women's National Basketball League, WNBL. On a mission to increase representation while filling a gap in global broadcasting, Goldberg partnered with The Common Spirit and Jungo TV to co-found the network. Inspired by her childhood passion for sports, the entertainer says AWSN has been 16 years in the making. Ever since I was a little kid, I always wanted to play sports. My brother could play. He played everything, said Goldberg, explaining how she never got to play because of her gender. So for years, I've been talking to people and saying, wouldn't it be great if we could go around the world, start getting young athletes in high school so that we can grow with them and grow up with them? I feel that will help us show that athlete, when they're done brilliantly, it doesn't matter who's doing it. We don't really have that relationship to women's sports, she continued. Having already launched in Asia, the Middle East, and on India's JioTV, Goldberg says AWSN will launch in the U.S. this week. This article was titled, Whoopi Goldberg Hopes to Change the Sports World with Her All Women's Sports Network, by Hanayah Philogene, The Griot, November 10th, 2024. Next, an article from Ebony titled Uterine Cancer and Its Impact on Black Women's Health, written by Kristen Morgan, November 1st, 2024. When you're older, putting off a trip to the doctor can happen because, well, life, and you wrap yourself in a cycle of, I'll get to it soon. When it comes to specific issues, such as uterine cancer, it is important to prioritize your health, especially if you're a black woman or a black person with a uterus. Uterine cancer is when the cells of the uterus grow out of control. The most common type of uterine cancer is endometrial cancer, EC, where the cells are growing out of control in the lining of the uterus called the endometrium. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, black women are diagnosed with uterine cancer at higher rates and have a higher mortality rate compared to other ethnic groups. This unwanted spotlight on Black women is exactly why knowing about it, catching it early, and learning about treatment options available is so important. So exactly what can you do to prevent uterine cancer? Because there is no screening for it, PAP and HPV tests only screen for cervical cancer and do not screen for uterine cancer. It's of the utmost importance to learn the signs and symptoms because treatment works best when cancer is found early. We spoke to Dr. Jessica Shepherd, MD, MBA, FHCOG, and asked about any early detection strategies and steps you can take to reduce your risks. Early detection strategies include understanding signs like abnormal bleeding, including any vaginal bleeding that takes place after menopause, or if you're still having your cycles, any significant change in your bleeding pattern, she explained. Moreover, it's important to understand that maintaining a healthy weight and being physically active can help lower your chances of getting uterine cancer. The risk of uterine cancer increases with age, making continued gynecologic care after menopause or after having children is essential. Most women diagnosed with uterine cancer are diagnosed in the perimenopausal or menopausal phase, so that shows that the main risk factor for uterine cancer is going to be age, Dr. Shepherd noted. Additionally, a family history of uterine, colon, rectal, ovarian, and some other cancers can increase your risk. Learn as much as possible about your family health history, share what you learn with a doctor, and ask them if genetic counseling and testing is right for you. If you have a high risk of some cancers due to family history, there's some things you can do to lower your risk. So what are the takeaways? Prioritizing your health by staying on top of routine gynecologic health appointments and seeing a doctor immediately if you have any abnormal bleeding is crucial. While Black women have a higher risk of being diagnosed with uterine cancer, treatment works best when it's detected early. You can lower your risk by maintaining a healthy lifestyle and understanding your personal risk factors, like your family health history. Remember, your health is your most valuable asset, and proactive care is the best defense. This article was written by Kristin Morgan, K-R-I-S-T-I-N, Ebony, November 1st, 2024. That's all the time we have for the African American Hour. My name is Rosemary Onkwe. Thanks for joining me.